Hello and welcome back to another episode of the I'm Learning Mandarin podcast. So today's topic is about the specific challenges that Mandarin learners face as compared with learners of other languages. So it's often said that people shouldn't compare different languages or say that some languages are harder than others. And I can certainly understand that sentiment. But at the same time, one of the issues people face when learning Mandarin, and this is something I certainly faced particularly earlier on, is that people around you studying other languages appear to progress at lightning speed. And particularly when you're on social media, such as Twitter, as I am, it can be easy to wonder if there's something wrong with you as a learner. You see other people who appear to have reached fluency in Spanish, say, in under a year, and you might have been studying Chinese for several years, but still don't feel fluent. And the reality in most cases is there's nothing wrong with you, and there may not even be anything wrong with your learning methods. And so I think it's helpful to be aware that there are particular challenges involved in learning Mandarin which make it, if not more difficult, then certainly more time-consuming than a lot of other languages. So to discuss this topic with me today is YouTuber and polyglot Alex, who has taken on a number of languages, including Mandarin, and is in a really good position to explore how the challenge of learning Mandarin differs from other languages for those who want to reach a high level. Okay, so Alex, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
As I was mentioning just before we pressed record, you're actually the first polyglot to appear on this show, which is great.
I'm honored.
And today's podcast, we're going to be discussing all about how like Mandarin matches up to other languages and that you've studied and how it compares, what the differences are. Is it more difficult? Is it easier in some ways? And we'll get into all those themes. But at first, I wanted to begin by asking you a bit about your language background. So how many languages do you speak, would you say? And tell us a bit about your background and how you came to become a polyglot that you are today.
So, you know, that's always a hard question to ask for a polyglot because, you know, people like us, we've dabbled in many languages. We've been around some time in some languages. But, I mean, the easy answer would be right now I speak 12 languages. And when I say speak, I don't mean like I'm completely fluent in all of them, but at least I could do conversation in at least definitely all of them, 12. And in other languages I'm studying, it would be another 3. So if you were really lenient, it would be 15 languages. Yeah.
And how did that come about? That didn't just happen by accident, right? Like, did you grow up with languages, surrounded by languages when you were growing up?
Not at all. Actually, I was born in a monolingual family, in a monolingual city/country with a pretty much monolingual background. Like all of my extended family cannot speak another language. So you could say I'm pretty much the first polyglot or multilingual in my bloodline. But the way that languages happened for me is that I was very, very lucky to be able to travel when I was younger. And I also had English classes that were like kind of mandatory at school. And so that set me up for more language learning later on. The funny part is I went to Canadian school while in Mexico and we learn, you know, English and a bit of French because, you know, Canadian. But the French was so bad that I never really stuck to it. Like in any case, that would have turned me off with languages, you know. But English, I always enjoyed. So that's the first language I became fluent in. And then, you know, just with my travels and exchanges abroad, I opened my door to more and more languages that I really did use in real life, you know. So I had a practical use for all my languages and just thinking about the next time I would be able to use them, the smiles I would get, the reactions I would get, and overall the experiences I would get through them. That's what motivated me to pursue these many languages and languages in general.
By the age of 18, when you like maybe left school, did you speak just English and Spanish, presumably?
Not quite, because when I went to elementary school, I took French and then stopped in, how you call it, middle school. And then in high school, I took French again, but against my own will. I actually wanted to study Chinese, but high school people would not let me, even though they gave Chinese classes, they just wouldn't let me have it as part of my curriculum. So you could say that I always was interested in Chinese because China was one of the first countries I visited and it completely opened my my mind, you know. It's and so because of these experiences, I was super interested in Chinese, but I couldn't quite study it in the curriculum, so I had to study it by myself, and that was actually the first language I studied by myself out of curiosity, out of you would say, like, just as a hobby.
You started self-studying Chinese in Mexico.
That's right. That's right. It was, I think, the year I started studying Chinese was 2010 or 2011. And back then, there was nothing. It was just a deserted land of no resources from Spanish, barely from English. Yeah, it was a quite lonely road, but I managed.
I recently published a blog about this, basically saying that in the past 10 years, someone like me who started learning Chinese 5 years ago finds it really difficult to relate to what it would have been like to start studying Chinese in 2010. Well, in 2010, I didn't have a smartphone. Most people didn't have a smartphone. There was no such things as apps. So tell us a bit more about, you said that it was very difficult. It was kind of a deserted landscape. What kind of resources were you using then to self-study Chinese at first?
It's very interesting because I use an app that is now extinct, or at least I don't know if it exists anymore. It was an app. I didn't have an iPhone or anything, but I had an iPad, a very, very old iPad. And there was this app I would use. It was probably the only app in the whole App Store. And I was lucky enough to have the American App Store, because if it was in the Mexican App Store, there would have been nothing. And so I used this one app, very rudimentary, very basic. And I just kind of stuck to it, you know. And that's pretty much all I could do. Books were out of the question for me. In Mexico, there's not much language learning resources in general, especially now in 2010. And so it was me and this app against the world, pretty much. I feel a bit bad of not remembering the name of it. But
what was the nature of that app? What kind of app was it? Like flashcards or?
Yeah, it was kind of like flashcards. It would also show you the traces, like the order of the traces. The stroke order, sorry. It was pretty comprehensive, relatively. It will show you example sentences and stuff. And I think, don't quote me on this, but I think you could also use your finger to write, which was a great advantage at the time.
Did it give you the, was there listening content? Was there reading content?
Not at all. No, no, no. It was just like flashcards with example sentences and audio, if I recall correctly. It was not until I finally was able to study Chinese at school, where I have contact with native teachers. But my experience was not that good either, because I feel like the teachers I got were not actually interested in teaching or in the language itself. They were just there like a job, you know, like to pass time, you would even say. And so my first approach to really speaking with Chinese people was not the one I expected. So that kind of demotivated me a bit at the moment. Also, because I did all this study through this app, I already know most of the kanji, I mean, Hanzi, and then the rest of the students would not know anything. So they were all lagging behind, or should I say, I was like way more advanced than all the courses. So I always felt out of place, you know.
When did you have the opportunity then to go to China, or how did things progress after that for you with your Chinese studies?
I had the chance to go a couple times during high school, a couple times to China in the summer. So that's where I could reconnect to my initial motivation, my passion, like, you know, I could reconnect to the reason why I was learning in the first place. So while I lost motivation, it's like a battery, you know, like you go to China and fill your battery, and then you go back to Mexico and you just drains out because there's like no enough Chinese people to talk to. And so these periodical trips to China were pretty much the fuel that kept me going. I really love China. I think it's probably my favorite country in the world. So it's a no-brainer for me to say, yeah, let's just pack up and go to China.
How long were you able to stay in China at one time? Was it like a couple of weeks or?
Yeah, a couple of weeks, not more, because of, you know, visa reasons and money reasons and things to do back home reasons. But eventually in university, I was able to go on an exchange abroad to Fudan University in Shanghai, and so that was better. That completely changed my Chinese game. When I arrived there, my Chinese was complete trash. You know, like it was just like rubbish. Sorry, it was like things stuck up together, and it was like my Chinese level at the moment was like three kids in a trench coat. But that When I arrived, it was so bad that I said, "Oh my God, I need to like really get the ball rolling. I really need to go serious on Chinese." And luckily, this time is where I could spend more time studying Chinese, practicing with real people in real life. Also, I used to go back to my dorm and just like hit SRS, you know. And so I spent around like 8 months in Shanghai, and this time was the best language immersion experience I ever had, probably.
It's interesting you mentioned how when you arrived in China, your Chinese was no good. Did you know that arriving already? Because one thing a lot of people say, and I had this experience, was that I was fairly confident about my Chinese. And then I remember I took a trip to Taiwan. You suddenly come face to face with the reality of needing to interact with people and needing to use Chinese for kind of survival and to get by. And this was a trip I took like 3 years ago, and at that time my Chinese was very basic, but I thought it was better than it was. I thought it was intermediate, but yeah, going to the actual country like gave me a reality check. Did you have a similar thing, or did you already know going in that your Chinese was limited?
It's a super interesting question. I had the same thing as you. I had that reality check. That's the word. I thought I would fare better, but it was just disastrous. And especially because I had a friend who also went to that exchange, and he started learning Chinese only very recently. And by the time we both got there, even though he only studied for, I don't know, like probably 6 months or something, his Chinese was way better than mine. So that was very humbling. And that made me want to go real crazy on it.
So you said that that immersive experience was the best that you've ever had. Tell us more about that then. What was that like?
Yeah, so I had the massive luck of having two Chinese roommates. I was living in a dorm with two other people, and both of them were Chinese. One of them was from Fujian, which gave me a really deep insight into, you know, Minnan and like, their accent, you know, they speak quite differently. So that gave me like more depth into like understanding more accents of Chinese. And he also was really nice, and he helped me a lot to improve my Chinese. The other guy, on the other hand, he was from Macau. And so, yeah, his mother tongue is Cantonese. So that was probably my first experience with Cantonese. But at the time, it was just too much for me. So I just decided to like just leave it for later. And yeah, pretty much I made many Chinese friends during this time. It was the best use of my time when it comes to language learning. And since language learning is like the best use of my time in general, personally, I think this was probably the best time of my life. So the exchange lasted eight months, but I made a vow to go back to China as often as I could to practice it. So in the coming years, I went another 2 weeks and 2 weeks at a time. And it is also very interesting because my next exchange, I could do two exchanges in my entire university. So the next exchange happened in Seoul, in Korea. And as you may know, Seoul is just a lot of Chinese people. So especially in my university for some reason. And then the first thing I did was join the Chinese Korean exchange club, which was probably one of the craziest things I ever did because it was a club for people, for Korean people to learn Chinese and for Chinese people to learn Korean. But I mean, I didn't care. I just wanted to practice Chinese. So I joined this group, and I remember the first day I enter, people were like, "What the hell is this guy doing here?" Like, you know, but luckily, I was okay with leaving my comfort zone, and I actually did a couple of friends there. I could meet people and practice my Chinese, and I was hanging out with Chinese people a lot in Seoul. So, yeah, I had to leave my comfort zone. I had to go out there and make the most out of every day in Seoul, and probably Seoul was the point in my life where my Chinese was better. Crazily enough, like you would imagine it would be when I was living in China, but it was actually in Seoul because I had the accumulated experience from China plus still a lot of immersion. The problem happened after when I graduated university and then I went to Japan. There are also a lot of Chinese people, but at the moment I was focusing more on Japanese. And so what happened? My Japanese went through the roof, you know, it was an amazing experience with Japanese, but unfortunately, Chinese is a very high maintenance language. So my Chinese level suffered attrition, or like, yeah, it just deteriorated. And it was never the same. After I tried getting my Chinese level back, it was just never the same.
That's very interesting, actually, because I've heard different stories about attrition with Mandarin, and I'm interested from you to hear more about like where that was noticeable. Because for some people, they often say that the first thing to go is it's more on the speaking side. Comprehension doesn't go quite as quickly; it's the speaking side that goes first. And particularly, people have reported that like they forget the tones. What was it like for you? So, where was the attrition most noticeable?
Vocabulary. I lost a lot of vocabulary. With other European languages, you can just create mental maps and follow a route to get to that word. But with Chinese, there's obviously no such thing. I can count the loan words with the fingers of my hand, So there's nothing to link it to. So like the vocabulary in my head is just isolated, right? So it's very easy to lose it. And so I could tell also because I have a really good Chinese friend who's very honest with me. And it was funny because I met her in Shanghai, but she went to live in Tokyo the same time I did. And she told me, Alec, your Chinese went to shit. Like, it became so incredibly bad. Like I cannot believe how bad it is. This is one thing I appreciate of Chinese people. They're very honest when they want to be.
When they want to be is the
Yeah,
key word,
exactly.
the key term there.
I would say when they're close enough. And she just told me this, and that's, I guess, as clear as water, Like when even a Chinese person tells you your Chinese is deteriorated, then that means you need to just work on it. So I committed to doing more online classes, kind of forcing myself to take more online classes, a bit of immersion where possible. But still, getting it back was not an easy thing. I mean, right now I would say I'm kind of getting back to my level of when I was in Seoul because I've been investing a lot of hours into italki, for example. So, but that took months and months of classes.
What I wanted to ask you is at your peak level, you were sort of around about an HSK5, which is a very considerable level of Mandarin. Then you went on to sort of focus more on Japanese and Korean and other languages. So with your experiences of studying all these languages, how did Mandarin compare in terms of the challenge of getting to the level that you did compared to other languages to get to a similar level?
Well, I pretty much started studying Chinese in 2011, let's say. And right now, I would say my level is B2. But in comparison, I started studying Japanese in 2016, and my level is C1. So, with half the time, I could get farther in Japanese. Sure, Chinese helped for Japanese, and that's something to consider as well. But even then, I think especially as a Spanish native speaker, Japanese doesn't pose as much as a challenge, I would say so grammatically speaking and phonologically speaking. I think it makes a lot of sense for the Spanish speaking mind. And so that takes me to Chinese, which is the entire opposite, I think English native speakers who learn Chinese have a much better time than Spanish native speakers who learn Chinese. I would say so, yeah. The phonology is closer, the logic in the grammar is closer. All my peers who are English native speakers have, in general, I'd say, a better time at grasping Chinese. Grammar specifically, I would say. For me, grammar poses a big issue in Chinese, especially in the higher levels. You know how the graph goes. It starts like very low because it's just like caveman talk. But the more you learn, the more you realize there's a lot of intricacies to it.
Oh yeah, exactly, yeah. In terms of listening and comprehension, did you find Mandarin was more difficult than Japanese to like pick out words, like, when you're trying to like get better at listening, for example?
That's a great question. In Chinese, it's just a lot of syllables clustered together, that's the way I say it. So it's hard to not know when a word starts and when the next word when a word ends and the next word starts. That doesn't really happen in Japanese, at least for me, because the particles do a great job of separating clauses inside a sentence. But when a Chinese person is speaking quickly, it's like a free-for-all. Like it could be, they're just shooting, and it could, anything could be anything. And even in reading, that happens sometimes. Like you read a cluster of two Hanzi, and then sometimes you don't know if it's the first two Hanzi, the meaning, or the second one plus and the one that follows. So there's a lot of ambiguity in that sense in Chinese, where in Japanese, there's simply not such ambiguity, because there's the particles I mentioned, and there's three writing systems. So, you know, it's very well separated, I would say. Yeah.
Mm. I should mention at this point that we don't want to put anyone off studying Chinese. I kind of feel one thing that used to put me off was that when I started studying Chinese, you see all these other people in the language learning community who are learning all these other different languages, and their rates of progress are just out of this world. And then you start to think, is there something wrong with me, because I'm progressing at like a hundredth of the pace of these people? And the fact is that there's nothing wrong with you. It's just that in many senses, Chinese is a very time-consuming, let's say, language. And so I think it's better to know that, and it's less off-putting, at least for me, psychologically, to know that and then realize there's nothing wrong with me and then just keep going, than to kind of have this pretense that, yeah, Chinese is just as easy as the languages. Some people say it's just as easy, it's just different.
No.
I think there are certain aspects of it that are just more, let's not say difficult, but time-consuming, certainly.
That's it. Right. So speaking of time consumption, I noticed that I take, for example, an hour of French, an hour of Italian, and I learn way much more than an hour of Chinese. Why? Because I could spend 10 minutes just analyzing a Cheng Yu, so an idiom, right? You could spend 10 minutes just doing that with your teacher. Whereas, idioms in French, German, European languages in general, they're pretty much a different variation of the one you have in your language, in my experience. So two birds with one stone, it's pretty much two birds with one P in Italian, or like two flies with one clap in Dutch. So it goes like that, right? But in Chinese, it's also two birds with one stone. But what I'm getting at is that Cheng Yus each have a story of its own. You know, and so you need to dive into the story of each idiom in order to understand it better. And so just Cheng Yus in general, I'm pronouncing it wrong for the sake of the conversation, Cheng Yu, they are so time-consuming. Probably for me, it's the hardest part of Chinese, because it's really hard to recall them. It's like a set of four different Hanzi that sometimes just feel like it has a random order, you know. And if you don't know the story, I mean, personally, it's really hard to remember them. So I always try to make mnemonic devices in my head, or like, even then, it's really hard. It's probably the number one hardest thing I found in Chinese, and will keep being hard. Because once you know the 50 more common Chinese, like, congratulations, you still need to learn a lot more to follow a proper Chinese conversation.
Yeah. The problem is that you mentioned that other, like, Romance languages, like Italian. I sometimes, as an experiment, the other day, for example, I was watching Netflix, and there's a show on Netflix, I can't remember what it's called, but it's like a courtroom drama, so there's quite a lot of like fast-paced language related to the courtroom, and I don't happen to know that kind of language in Chinese, or not very much of it. So I was struggling with it, even with subtitles. I was struggling to understand what this was in Chinese. It was dubbed in Chinese, right? It was originally in English, but it was dubbed in Chinese. I changed the dubs to Italian to see what would happen. And just for some context, in terms of the breadth of vocabulary that I'm currently at, so I'm approaching HSK6 level, which is the highest proficiency in Mandarin. Approaching that level, I changed the dubs to Italian, and I found like that I could understand about as much, maybe slightly more. So that was, having never studied Italian a day in my life, after 5 years of Mandarin.
That's devastating. That happened to me too. That happened to me too. Just studying an hour of Italian, I can, like, In my life, I've taken probably like at most 20 lessons of Italian, and I would consider myself fluent. Like I can get around in Italian, I talk in Italian, no problem. But I've taken probably 1,000 hours of, I don't even know how many hours of Chinese, and I'm still very nervous before I have to speak Chinese in a real life setting, you know. It's just the way it is. I try to not think much about it. Mentality plays a huge part. You were mentioning in language Twitter, for example, you would see a lot of people documenting the progresses for European languages, but it has absolutely nothing to do with your progress in East Asian languages. So I try to not judge myself. I think I'm successful at times, and that's an advice I would give to a lot of people. Don't judge yourself. Chinese is Chinese. It's a beast on its own. You cannot compare it to anything else. Even comparing it to Japanese, personally, is not doable. It's not healthy. It's not something you should do.
Absolutely. It's that you don't have any advantages. You're not given any favors, and to acquire enough vocabulary to just be completely fluent, as in switch on TV and just be able to understand everything that's on there. The amount of exposure that you need to get used to different accents, the amount of a huge amount of vocabulary that you need just to be comfortable, because you don't have the gift of cognates of words that sound similar to languages that you're used to, then it's just you just need to push through and persevere, but it's a mental challenge for sure.
There's something very interesting to consider as well. In the case of Japanese, you can bullshit yourself around the language, you know? If you forget the word for, let's say, phone, no? The Japanese would be ketai, right? But if you just forget the name, you can just say, smartohono. So just pronounce it like the Japanese way, English in the Japanese way. End of story. And everyone understands you, can continue with your life, whatever. Mandarin doesn't have the luxury. You know it very well, so it will never be the same. And for example, Indonesian is a language that I've studied that is very similar to Chinese in that sense. There's very little room for, you know, copying out with another language. So actually, Indonesian, even though it's one of the most regarded as one of the most like the easiest languages to learn, it's still very hard because there are just not many cognates. So, you know, cognates can make or break your experience with the language if you're not patient enough.
Absolutely. With Chinese, the so-called cognates, like the loan words, they don't even sound anything like English. Like the other day, I came across a word that was marked in the dictionary as a loan word. That means that it's supposed to have derived from English originally. And the word was ya pian, ya pian. Can you guess what that meant?
It's like supposed to be a loan word.
You won't guess it. I'll just say it. It's supposed to be opium. Worlds away, like no one would ever
Oh.
guess that. There's no way you could guess that just from the sound alone. You'd need to be told. So those are the so-called loan words that exist in Mandarin.
That happens a lot with geography. So the names of places just sometimes follow no logic, you know. So you need to learn geography away from like all the way from zero, pretty much feels like sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes I say to my friends, like, the countries in Chinese that sound the closest to the way they do in English, like for example, Xibanya. But like, if you just said that to like an English person or a Spanish person, and said, "Guess what I'm talking about," they wouldn't know.
Exactly. And it goes from things that are like relatively similar to stuff like Greece, Xilan, or like Russia, Switzerland. You know, it's like something that I haven't found in other languages. Like in Japanese, it would be just like in English, you know, Grisha or like Switzerando. And even Indonesian would be the same. But Chinese is the only language I found that you need to pretty much learn geography from scratch. Yeah. But by the way, I want to make a correction. It's not Switzerland. It's Suisse.
Another thing I wanted to talk to you about was something that we've also kind of tweeted to each other about, which is experiences around Chinese politeness. Did you find though that Chinese people were like overall like more encouraging or less encouraging than other people from other languages when you told them that you were learning Chinese or when you tried to speak Chinese with them?
Yeah, I would say they're probably among the top most encouraging people I've come across. to the point where they overinflate your Chinese level. And at first, when you don't know, that feels good. But when you come across the hard truth, it has the opposite effect. You know, it's devastating. So you gotta be cautious with that as well. But in general, people would be really, really stoked that I can speak Chinese, however little or much. Yeah.
Yeah, I had a whole episode on that theme of people telling us that our Chinese is awesome right from the beginning, and like massively inflating our egos, and then and then we have them popped when we realize, like, maybe like you had an experience with like your friend who you got to know a bit better, and of course when you know the Chinese people know you well and consider you like a close friend, then they kind of turn 180 degrees, and very often they'll be extremely brutally honest with you all of a sudden.
Yeah. So I'd rather they be like that instead of, you know, they giving me false hopes. And then being brave enough to undergo an interview because my friend told me my Chinese was perfect, and then completely tanking the interview, you know. I would appreciate if people were just honest right off the bat, because they can, I know it's not their intention. Their intention is always the best, but I'd rather they just be honest. Like in the case of Dutch, you know, no matter your level of Dutch, people are going to tell you your Dutch is shit, which is, you know, fair enough.
Do you have plans then to return to Mandarin in the future, or have you kind of put that on the back burner for now, or what are your plans in the future when it comes to Mandarin?
So I've been taking classes, pretty much like twice or thrice a week of Mandarin. And I did a crazy thing of starting Cantonese recently. So that also counts as Mandarin practice, because my classes happen in Mandarin, and pretty much 90% of the resources I use are in Mandarin. So I count that into my study time. And that's also a great way to, you know, review the basics. And crazily enough, undertaking Cantonese has made me more interested for Mandarin, because before I could only see Mandarin like unidimensionally, you know. But now, after having another Sinitic language in my life, I can appreciate it more. So that's interesting. That has revitalized my motivation and my plans for the future are just to be fluent, like in Chinese, like. There's no question about it. I always knew that I wanted to become fluent in Chinese even before I started studying it. It's probably my life dream / goal. But precisely because of that, I'm taking my time with it. Like, I'm not in a rush or anything. I know it takes time, especially when you live in China, it takes time. So it's just my first love, my first language love. And it's like, you know, it's probably a weird comparison to do, but it's like getting married to the language. Like, that's the one I want to marry and like be with until the end of time, pretty much. So, yeah, that's pretty much my plan. I don't have a deadline. I don't have a specific metric, but I just want to be real good in Chinese, you know, and unlock this culture that really fascinates me, drives me crazy, the history, everything, you know.
That's perfect. Well, it sounds like we have a similar goal, and I wish you all the best for the future, and I'm sure we'll keep connecting on Twitter as well. So thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me. Amazing questions, and I hope whoever listens to this finds a lot of value in it.
Hey there, thanks for listening to this episode of the I'm Learning Mandarin podcast. If you're currently looking to improve your Mandarin speaking skills, you might like to check out my Peak Mandarin newsletter, run by me and my friend Will Hart. We share exactly what you need to do to become fluent in Chinese based on our experience. Subscribe to the newsletter, and we'll also send you a free copy of my ebook, Lessons from a Chinese Learning Phenomenon, which tells the story of exactly how Will Hart learned to speak near native level Chinese within a 1.5 year period, how I put his techniques into practice to become fluent myself, and how you can too. To subscribe to the newsletter, you can go to peakmandarin.com or click the link in the description. That's all for now. Until next episode, goodbye.